of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. Our town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We are a community of roughly 10,000 people. Every one of those people has been impacted by this long and terrible pandemic. Not everyone has actually caught the virus, dare I say, yet. But all of us have friends or loved ones who've suffered through it. Compared to other places, our death rate is low. But it doesn't mean that we have not suffered. Whether you're a school teacher, a sailor, a construction worker, or a computer geek, you have felt the hot breath of COVID. My guest today is someone who's in a unique position to observe our ever-changing community. My guest today is Port Townsend Police Chief Thomas Olson. Think of it, who's better situated to watch a town grow and change than the chief of police? The police chief of any town occupies a vital position. A competent police chief reacts to society's changes. An excellent police chief anticipates those changes and works to prepare his or her town for the future. Chief Olson has only been running things here in Port Townsend for a little under 2 years, but he's already making his mark. But before we get into what he's actually doing as police chief, I think we need to get to know a little bit of his background. We're all a sum of our parts and carry our history with us. I'd like to start out as I always do. Welcome to the show, Chief Olson.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start, as I always do, with a fairly simple question. Are you a local boy, born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
Unfortunately, I am not. I've been in the state of Washington for about 34 years, but I grew up in northern Minnesota.
Okay, and what did your folks do?
My dad was a contractor, carpenter. He traveled a lot to do that work because we lived in an area that didn't have a lot of work. So he ended up being a Finnish carpenter as most of his work. And then later, when we started doing more work and I was his sidekick, we did a lot of remodels on cabins and just turning old cabins into nice new ones because we lived in the middle of the lakes and it was a resort area. And a lot of cabins built in the early turn of the century needed to be updated.
Okay. So, you told me the other day that you're one of four kids. And in your household, was there an understanding that you were headed to university, or was it not a priority?
Well, you know, my dad being in construction, he actually barely made it through high school. He missed like 34 days of his senior year because he was a hunter and a fisher, and that's what he enjoyed doing more. So he did just enough to get through high school and then ended up in construction. And so he wasn't educated. My mom was not educated. She worked also in the service industry. So it wasn't that it wasn't a high priority. It wasn't in our family.
Okay. So when you were in high school, there are a few kids who have it really fixed in their head. You know, I want to be X when I get out of high school. But not all kids are that way. Where did you fall on that spectrum? Did you know what you wanted to be?
I knew pretty early on. My sister, who was a few years older than me, she went to college, and she was in college when I was coming out of high school. But my dad always told me if there's one thing he could have done, that was to go into the military. He unfortunately was unable to get drafted because of flat feet and poor hearing. So he's like, if I had an option, I would have went into the Air Force. And so I really looked into it. I looked into all the branches, but Air Force really stood out for me. And I knew my junior year that I was going to go into the Air Force. I did the early enlistment while I was still in high school.
Good. And the Air Force would have opened a lot of different opportunities for you. Where did you end up going?
My vision at that time was I wanted to be an air traffic controller, but I couldn't even test for that till I got to basic. And when I got to basic, I was so focused on just getting through basic that I decided not to be, you know, stand out in any way. And I let the military decide, the Air Force, where I was going to go. And they selected the security police, which is a form of security and police for the Air Force. And so that was my career path in the Air Force.
Did you get to travel anywhere with the Air Force?
Yep. I wasn't ready to travel too far, so I chose to go back to North Dakota, which was about 2.5 hours from my home. I was stationed at Grand Forks Air Force Base, and I worked out in the missile fields, and I was a responder to the missile silos when the alarms would go off. 12 hours a day, we would respond across North Dakota to different silos and missile sites, and check alarms or walk the sites and go down inside them and make sure there wasn't anything but bunnies and weeds blowing across the sites. But I did that for about a year before I was selected to go to the Netherlands over in Europe.
Wow, that must have been quite an adventure for a young guy from Minnesota.
It was. It was quite an adventure because it was a smaller base. I mean, we had about 20-some F-15 fighters, but we had two on alert, and we were the air protection over the North Sea and Northern Europe. So when any of those big bear Russian planes would come close to Europe, we would launch our aircraft, and they would intercept them somewhere over the North Sea.
Okay.
And that was back in the 86, 87, so right towards the end of the Cold War.
Did you ever visit Amsterdam?
Actually, I lived about 30 minutes out of Amsterdam. And so we went there quite a bit. It was an easy train ride. And, you know, for young military guys, we were always looking for something to do.
Yeah.
So Amsterdam was one of the places that we went.
A destination for young guys, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I would think so. So when you got out of the military, I guess it's typical that they more or less take you back to where you joined, right?
I got out in Europe. I chose, I actually got out a little bit early because in 1988, the military was doing a rollback and they were reducing the forces. So they gave me an option. They basically said, re-enlist for 4 more years or we're going to separate you. And at that time, I felt like, you know, I've done 4 years. I've been all over Europe. I didn't see it as a career for me at that time. So I ended up getting out. I stayed in Europe for about a month because I had a car. I had to wait for my car to get to New York City before I could go anyway. And so I separated while in Europe, flew back to New York, got my car, and I drove back to Minnesota. And I ended up staying with my sister, and she got me a job at a local fitness center as a fitness instructor. And that's where I ended up back in 88.
Okay. And so did you have a plan then?
I really enjoyed what I did in the Air Force. I learned a lot. And so I'm like, you know, where can I do this? And I really wanted to be a Minnesota State Trooper because, you know, you always knew when those guys drove into town, they had the nicest equipment. They were always real tall and just I just wanted to be one of those. Unfortunately, I didn't have the education that they were requiring. It required a 2-year degree. I was shy of that. And the next class was going to be 18 to 24 months down the road. So
it's a long time.
I decided I wanted to be a state trooper, but it wasn't going to be in Minnesota, at least not right away. And that's what brought me out to Washington. I was working a couple of jobs in Minneapolis, and I had some friends out here in Washington, and they suggested I come out and stay with them and test. And I did that, and I tested on a Friday and a Monday and a Tuesday, and my boss in Minnesota was notified on Wednesday that they were going to hire me about a month later. So it was a really quick process for me.
Great. And so did you start out by going to the academy?
I did. I got hired and I was a cadet. I worked prior to the academy just in the field as a pass cadet on Snoqualmie Pass, just assisting motorists through the winter because I was hired in October and I went to the academy in February. So I spent some time there, and then I went to the State Patrol Academy in February of 1989.
And what was your first assignment?
My first assignment was East Tacoma.
Aha. Now, I understand that East Tacoma is not exactly sort of a peaceful, tranquil bed of serenity.
Well, if you just live there and you're not in policing, it's a great place to live because you don't really know what goes on around you. But yes, it was for the State Patrol, it was the what we call the busiest beat in the state because we had the county roads, we had the state routes, we covered everything, all traffic law enforcement, all collision investigation. You know, you got to work right up to the city of Tacoma, all the way out to the park entrance of Mount Rainier.
So there's a fair amount of gang activity there, right?
Well, you had the Crips and the Bloods coming into Tacoma in the late 80s, so we were definitely seeing part of that. We had some Samoan gangs. You had the Chalashan community, which was the Asian community, and there was certainly some organized crime going there. That affected us all the way out into the areas where we worked as well.
So how long did you spend in East Tacoma?
So I was there about 11 years just under 11 years before I got promoted to sergeant. And I took a transfer to South Seattle, which was the office right near the airport.
And did you stay there for a while?
I actually worked there for about 2 years before I transferred back to Tacoma. And then I was a sergeant in East Tacoma for nearly 10 years before taking a transfer back up to Seattle, up to North Seattle, by the University of Washington, where I spent my last 18 months or so with the State Patrol.
Well, at some point, I know you decided that you should indeed go ahead and get a degree, but you ended up not just getting one. I believe you have 5 degrees at this point, right?
Well, I throughout my time with the State Patrol, I was taking a class here, taking a class there, and slowly working towards that associate's degree through Pierce College there in Pierce County. I got that accomplished. I had went back into the military a couple of years after I finished the academy, actually about a year after the academy. And so I completed 2 associate's degrees through the military, one in security administration, which was part of my job there. And then when I became a first sergeant, I completed one in human resource management. My last 5 years, I knew I had to get on it if I was going to pursue another career or even extending this career. So I went back to school in about 2009, 2010, and I finished my bachelor's degree and took about a month or two off, and I turned around and started my master's, and I completed my master's about a year later.
Excellent. And so I know that you actually officially retired from the state police, but people don't really, I think of someone retiring in your 40s. So tell me how that works.
Well, that was one of the things that really attracted me to the Washington State Patrol is they had a separate retirement where when you finish 25 years, it doesn't matter how old you are, you're eligible to retire and receive benefits as soon as you retire. So I was 23 when I got hired, and so I was 48 when I retired. I did 25 and a half years, and I was able to retire at 48 or leave there and collect my retirement benefits right at 48.
But you weren't about to just kick back and retire in your backyard, were you?
No, unfortunately, I wasn't. I would have liked to, but I got remarried, and I had 2 kids, and they require me to continue to work. And so they are now 12 and 14. And here in the Port Townsend school system, one's at Blue Heron. And my son just moved up. He's going to be a freshman at the high school.
Cool. So there's a little bit of a gap in our story here because you actually worked for a while at the University of Washington. So you joined there as a lieutenant, I believe.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough that when I was looking at retiring, I was interviewing for a job down in Oregon as a deputy chief for a college down there, but I didn't know a lot about campus policing. So I asked my lieutenant at the State Patrol if he would introduce me to the chief of police for the University of Washington and see if I could interview him and just kind of get some insight on what campus policing was all about. I did that. I did well in my interviews. I was a finalist, but I did not get selected for the job in Oregon. But I had gotten to know the chief, and he let me know when they a few months down the road that they had an opening for a lieutenant coming if I was interested in applying. And I did. I went through the process, and I was selected and hired as a lieutenant at the University of Washington in 2014.
So that's a very different job on campus versus, you know, in East Tacoma. We have a very short amount of time here, but could you just sort of give us a nutshell of what the major difference is?
Well, the nutshell is everything that was important at the State Patrol was not important at the campus, and everything that's important on campus was not things that we dealt with at the State Patrol. It was really about community caretaking. I got much more involved with the community policing. We were there to really just help these young adults get through school and get their education and move on, because they're our future leaders. And so we had a number of other organizations on campus that helped us do that. Our biggest challenges were the visitors to the campus, the people that came there to victimize our students, staff, and faculty. So those were our biggest challenges. But if you can imagine, there is certainly a lot of politics and things that go on campuses that that helped us sometimes do our job and then really hindered us from doing our job as well. But I really learned a lot about a different type of policing. And when I came here, part of the interview process, that's one of the things that I really talked about is my diversity in policing and the different things that I've learned from being from a very large agency and then from a middle-sized agency and working strictly traffic law enforcement and some community issues, and then going to an organization that's all about community.
Okay. Yeah. And so when did you actually start as chief of police here?
In May 3rd of 2021, so a little over a year.
And what did you see as the challenges going in, and did it play out that way?
You know, some of the personal challenges was I had never worked in municipal policing. So working with a city manager, working with the city council, one of the biggest challenges I saw that the department really didn't have a sound direction. They didn't have a strategic plan. And we still don't have one because of the pandemic. And something I did not anticipate was losing nearly my entire staff. I've had retirements. I've had people leave the state. I've had some lateral to other agencies. And so I've really focused all my time that I've been here on recruiting and retention and rebuilding the department.
I don't think most of our listeners realize how large or small the police department actually is here. I think you told me that at the University of Washington, the full complement officers, but also the office people, was like 60 people?
80.
80, yeah, okay. Yeah. And what does that compare to here if you were at full complement?
Well, if we were at full complement, I would have about 19 or 20.
Okay.
So a little bit smaller.
Yes.
Which requires you to do more because you have less people that are specific to tasks. So all of us kind of have to pick up and do a little bit more and diversify the work that we do.
Now, you have hired a couple of people, but you're still looking for good people. And so I'll put in a plug for you and say that if one of our listeners is very interested in this, I'm sure Chief Olson would be interested to hear, if you're qualified, of course. During COVID, I mean, that sort of impacted everything. One of the things we all read is that crime nationally has been up during COVID. Is that indeed true?
Well, as I go to different meetings and conferences with my peers, that's certainly the message that I'm hearing, whether it's nationally or across the state of Washington. Not only through COVID, but through some incidents that have occurred in our profession and even some further legislation here in the state of Washington has really dropped our numbers in our police department. So every police department is running short-staffed, no different than we are. With some of the legislation impacting how we do our job, it has caused a level of crime to go up. There was, the talk of defunding police and reducing forces and reducing our abilities to do our job. That message did not only get out, I mean, it got out to all the citizens, to even those that are victimizing others, so they knew that there would be less chance of them to get caught. One of the things was the elimination of pursuits. And so people are stealing cars and this and that, and they know that we can't chase them, you know, if it's just a property crime or a stolen car.
Well, what about the crime rate here in Port Townsend? What has happened? I know you have some numbers that...
Yeah. So I brought some of my data with me, but okay. I think the good thing for people to know is we are not necessarily on the same trend as the state or the rest of the country. We're actually doing pretty good.
That's good.
In our overall calls for service as well as our crimes. I do an annual report, and I usually compare that to the last couple of years. And so, like, pre-COVID in 2019, we had about 11,000 calls for service. And then through COVID, we stopped going to certain calls, and those were reduced down into, like, 2020 was 7,600, and then 7,900 last year. The numbers that I pulled today show us an estimated calls of about 7,000 for 2022. So the call volume continues to go down. We went from an average of 30 calls a day in 2019, and we're at an average of 20 calls a day now. I mean, having less staff could have an impact, but whether we have 20 officers or 10 officers, the amount of call volumes are going to come in. The challenge for us is we just haven't been able to be as proactive as we would like to.
Right.
And that's part of the initiative and the strategic plan that I'm working on now to assist that.
But calls don't necessarily tell the full story. What results from those calls?
Yeah, so I pulled what we call part one crimes or priority crimes, if you will. And those crimes are murder, negligent manslaughter, aggravated assault, arson, burglary, robbery, motor vehicle theft, and rape. So of those calls, in 2019, we had 166. 2020, we went up to 196, but 101 of those were burglaries. Hmm. Burglaries are property crimes where there's not a victim involved per se. It's a building or a car or something where there's not a crime against a person. And then in 2021, we were at 134, so we dropped quite a bit. And then based on the numbers I pulled today, as of this year, we're at 53, which is an estimate of 90, which would put us a little bit less than 100 for the entire year. So I didn't pull the percentage of a drop, but it's quite extensive, actually.
Okay, so quickly, because we're running short, but what are your tips so that people like me can try to avoid being the victim of some of that?
Well, the biggest tips that I can continue to give is to secure your property. Those are our biggest crimes. You know, we have a lot of assaults, minor assaults, but securing your property. The majority of our auto thefts, we have had this year 13 auto thefts this year, and the majority of them, the keys were left in the car. or another car with the keys was unsecured. Lock up your cars in your driveways. Take your property and secure it in the house, in the trunk, but don't leave it visible to give a person a reason to break into your car. Bikes, anything on the side of the house, sheds in the back. Just secure your property.
Yeah. I mean, if people feel secure, and on the one hand, that's good. On the other hand, you've got to remember to lock your door and lock your car and lock your bike. So it's a hard thing to get your head around. Okay, quickly, the vision for the future. Let's assume you've got everyone in line. You're ready to go. You mentioned something about getting the department accredited.
Yes. So, I mean, my big three for over the next year is a strategic plan, because I have to have a strategic plan in place before I can get the department accredited.
Right.
It's kind of one of those mandatory things. I also have a chief's council that I want to put together, and it would be an advisory council between me and the community, where I would be bringing things that may impact the community, whether it's policy, and getting their input on that, as well as the community bringing things, concerns to me. So that would be a forum where we can engage ideas. It's not a forum where I want to have conflict. It's pro. We're all there to find solutions to our challenges.
Well, one idea that you shared with me the other day I thought was really good, which is the idea of assigning officers to specific area of town so that people in the community would know, you know, Officer Bob or whatever.
Yep, absolutely. That's one of our community policing goals, is to sectorize the city and assign those sectors to officers. So there's always going to be one officer that is, he knows everything that's going on in those neighborhoods, and he's going to go door to door, he or she, because we may have a female officer working with us real soon.
Good.
But they're going to go door to door. They're going to get to know their community. They're going to hold community meetings. And so we're going to go to where they can have that face-to-face contact and get out of the car and talk to people.
You obviously have your plans to stay around in Port Townsend. I understand that you and your family have a business here now.
Yeah. We bought Oh Yummy Frozen Yogurt right down on Taylor Street, a couple of doors down from the Rose Theater.
Right.
And it's really a passion of my wife's, and she kind of runs the place, and I kind of work for her when I'm there. But it's a family business. My kids are in there, and they help us with it. We don't have any other employees, so it's just us right now. We're really enjoying it. And yes, it's just another example of that. I plan to be here for a while. I've got two kids in school. This is the last place I want them to go to school. So I am really dedicated to being here and making this really a great place to live for my family, but also a great place to work for my department and my officers.
Okay. And you, I believe, were a coach for at least one of your kids. I don't know whether it's both. Are you still doing that sort of stuff?
Well, I was helping coach the middle school football team last year, and I was also helping coach the high school golf team, which I want to continue to do. My son will be on that team as well. He was fortunate enough to get to play as an eighth grader with the high school team and get that experience this last year. Yeah, I plan to continue to do that while I'm here as well.
Okay, well, Chief Olson, thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had more time. And, you know, in a year or so, I'll revisit this and see where you are when you have a full complement of officers. And thank you for making the time to be on the show. I really appreciate it. You have been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today, Chief Thomas Olson, Chief of Police here in Port Townsend. I also want to thank our editor, Sonny Flores. He is very important to the show. He cleans up what we say and makes us sound intelligent and elegant and all sorts of things. In addition to thanking both the Chief and Sonny, I want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with KPTZ during these troubled times. We're all limping through this pandemic together, and hopefully we're about done with it. Meanwhile, keep listening to KPTZ. We're a community radio station by and for the people of Jefferson County. Everyone who works here is a volunteer. We work here because we believe Jefferson County needs a free local voice. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis, signing off for today. But please keep listening to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Marianne McNellis and edited by Sonny Flores.